Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for over 2.5 years shared with KLRB listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and other abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show. It's the most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. The week is November the 19th, 1973, and this is program number 127. It's 2.5 years of Dialogue Conspiracy on KLRB. This week, in a few days, marks the 10th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Each of us has a distinct memory of that particular moment in our lives. The adults who were around at that time, everyone can recall a particular instant when they were told that the president had been shot and then expired. The fact that it affected so many different people in every country of the world, around the entire globe, from all walks of life, in the identical manner, is symbolic of what John Kennedy was, and more important, what he could have become. There was genuine grief, there was loss, there was a fear of the future in a moment, and the realization that the people on this earth had lost a friend. In his inaugural address, Kennedy said that the work that he was doing would not be finished in 100 days or in 1,000 days, but there has to be a beginning. And coincidentally, in exactly 1,000 days, John Kennedy was murdered. His memory lived on in strange forms of naming airports or a space station or a school. Idle talk conversation, for the most part, it wasn't a living memory except for a handful of people who were anxious to find out why the man was slain and if his policies would be changed because he had been assassinated. His own family, the only description I can use for them is disgusting. Their main concern, his widow, is to erect an expensive library in his memory where you'll look at his rocking chair and his books. And in the meantime, Camelot gets destroyed, his goals piece by piece. The wings are pulled off like you see a bug, torn apart, legs and limbs, and the family sits by and watches this. His brother is the Attorney General, kept undeveloped pictures in the National Archives. Instead of putting them in the archives or turning them over to the Warren Commission and demanding they be developed, he kept them undeveloped when a proof of more bullets in the president's body than the Navy doctor said was possible, and they were in his personal possession. We saw this brother, who was the Attorney General at the time, slain himself a few years later, and then a few years later, his brother, who was a senator, was with a female who was murdered in order to eliminate this man from the presidential election in 1972, and this man still sits quietly and has an interview in McCall's this month and accepts. His interpretation of the Warren report is, "I met with Earl Warren, and it's suitable for me." So the deaths in their family mounted up, and they sit in a manner that is beyond anything that I can figure out. Everyone says they're afraid, but there's no safety in living. Knowing what they know, they can be killed anyway, and I should think they would have spoken up. A generation, according to John Kennedy, was supposed to go forth armed with what he referred to as truth and justice and peace in this world. But America, 10 years later, was capable of none of these things. It has been a continuous decade of lies, injustices, and continuous wars. We slumped to the lowest place of the dung heap of nations. In my mind, we will be known as the decade of murders and assassins all over the world, instigated by the same people who killed John Kennedy. In the same inaugural address of John Kennedy, he referred to enemies. The enemies of mankind were not the political stereotypes that our country had heard Since the time Richard Nixon ran for Congress and all his cohorts, he wasn't yelling about communism. He wasn't talking about crime or them or the crime on the streets or other countries or enemies. If you hear the inaugural address, it'll probably be played maybe on radio stations this week. The enemies, if you listen to his speech, were tyranny, poverty, disease, and war. And it wasn't the tyranny of communists over free nations. It was the tyranny of people over each other everywhere, and poverty everywhere, and war everywhere, and disease. He asked for the control of arms specifically for both nations in his speech. He didn't say the superiority of arms over Russia and China. He asked for the wonders of science for all mankind, for all mankind. There was no special group that was to do it. He wanted to join hands with all mankind. There was nothing about brain implantations and torture machinery or germ warfare, napalm, bottled diseases that are going to be used against us, various viruses that will be released, and we're going back into the using experiment with germ warfare. He didn't talk about that kind of science. He didn't have it in mind. He asked for a common peace mentioned in Isaiah, where we put the sword down for the plowshare. He asked to end the jungle of suspicion and have a new world of law. That's what John Kennedy asked for. He didn't talk about CIA agents and data banks and computerized police and social security numbers that marked everybody from the day they were born, or the fingerprinting of law students because they're such cheaters. Before they even apply for school, they lie so much they're fingerprinted. Mail open, surreptitious entry, wiretapping, bugging, eavesdropping, covert operations against mankind. That wasn't what he had in mind. That's what we have at the end of 10 years. He asked to end the jungles of suspicion for a new world of law. Ever since his death, there's been a diabolical effort to blame the Vietnam War on John Kennedy. The politicians say, in the same tradition of John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, General Eisenhower, you know, Richard Nixon can say, listing them all, the Pentagon Papers can show you without a doubt, and other documents will show you that John Kennedy intended the troops out of Southeast Asia by 1964. This myth that he was a warmonger, that he was going to send ground troops and escalate that war, is nothing but a blatant lie. There's nothing wrong with sending advisors over there. China is a large nation. We weren't at peace with China. We are a large nation with investments all over the world and Americans all over the world, and there's nothing sinister about sending advisors if you're going to bring them all home, bring the troops home in 64. Nobody in Washington, D.C. has been arrested or punished or charged for forgery in the White House, for forging John Kennedy's name and associating with the murder of Diem in Vietnam. You don't see Howard Hunt charged with forgery, or Dean had those documents, or Patrick Gray. All that goes unnoticed. John Kennedy was far from perfect. I'm not saying he was perfect, but I think he tried. He had a sense of history, and he had heroes. And when his back was hurt and he had surgery, he wrote a book, Profiles of Courage. And I think that when you look to a person's heroes, you can know pretty well what kind of a man or woman you're speaking to. His heroes weren't pinball manufacturers, the underworld, the gangsters in Bahamas, the Las Vegas gaming table group. Those weren't his heroes. That isn't where his inspiration came from. That's something new in the White House. He had a sense of heroes, and he wrote about them. He tried to elevate our minds to the highest of what we're capable of doing, instead of hiding a lot of the things that we know go on. He didn't praise all the filthy, dirty tricks that we do know exist in this world. He elevated, or tried to elevate, the mind to people who have higher methods of living so that somebody can emulate those systems. I didn't begin to study who killed John Kennedy for any personal reason that I thought he was perfect. I was a registered Democrat in those days. I wouldn't support the Democrats now because there is no Democratic Party. There's just one party in Washington, and it's called the Military-Industrial Party that Eisenhower warned us about. The Democrats are so infiltrated with agents, you can't tell one from the other, and I stopped being a member of the Democratic Party. I did go see John Kennedy in the Coliseum in Los Angeles the night of the acceptance speech when he was nominated. We do have the same birthdays in common, May 29th, so certain Gemini traits carry through if you believe in these things, and I do in a way. I think that we may have had certain habits or ways of approaching things in common, but I didn't have any reason to be particularly fond of the man for going into my research. I had a, let's call it a purely selfish motive. A lot of people say, why did you do your research? Well, frankly, let's put it at a very base thing. Before we get to the altruism, let's talk about purely selfish reasons, because that's what motivates a person many times. In the first thing, your instinct is self-survival. I happen to be Jewish. My family is Jewish. My five children are. And when Jack Ruby went into the Dallas jail and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John Kennedy, on November the 24th, 1963, Ruby was asked right away, why did you do it? All the members of the police department knew Ruby, and Ruby was very proud of what he did. He thought he'd be a hero, and he made the remark, I did it to prove a Jew had balls. Well, that statement worried me. I didn't know what Jack Ruby meant. In a few days, I realized through the media that in Dallas, Texas, I knew right offhand that Dallas, Texas was the home of commercial anti-Semitism, large amounts of money from H.L. Hunt or Clarence Mannion, the right, extreme right wing, comes from the Dallas area. And I know about the broadcast, the anti-Semitic, the anti-black propaganda. And here was Ruby, a Jew, in the anti-Semitic community, trying to show them he's a hero. 2 days after the shooting, there were bumper stickers out and headlines, Oswald was a communist and Rubenstein, the Jew, killed him. Well, it was very interesting in my mind. As a matter of fact, this came out immediately as soon as Ruby had shot Oswald. It was interesting in my mind that they referred to him as Rubenstein, because Ruby legally was Jack Ruby for 20 years, and the American opinion, the Birch Society literature, always referred to him from that time on as Rubenstein. Mr. Oliver, who writes for American Opinion, or did, spoke in Boston a few years later that all the Jews in America should be gassed, similar to Germany. Bernard Weissman, the man whose name was on the ad the day that John Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas, there was an ad wanted for treason, accusing John Kennedy of being in cohorts with the communists. The name on the ad was Bernard Weissman, and when Bernard Weissman testified before the Warren Commission, he said that his name was used because it was Jewish and they wanted a Jewish name on that ad. I didn't know about that until the Warren Report came out and the hearings I got the following December, 1 year later. But the use of Jack Ruby, a Jew, to prove his heroism in an anti-Semitic town made me wonder if, by that time I already knew how the Rosenbergs had been framed and they were given the death penalty for being spies, and there was a document forged at the hotel in Albuquerque supposedly with their name, and I realized, thinking of Rosenberg and Rubenstein, that maybe this country was going towards an anti-Semitic pitch. And then later, Weissman, instead of erasing my fears or doubts, confirmed it worse, because he had his name used the day of the assassination, so they'd link another Jew, Rubenstein, Oswald the Communist, and Bernard Weissman. Well, the ad that was paid for in the Dallas newspaper that day, one-third of the ad was paid for by Lamar Hunt, the son of H.L. Hunt, and the Birch Society wrote the ad, and the men who brought Bernard Weissman to Dallas, Texas, were part of the U.S. Army intelligence group that had been working together in Germany and came to the Dallas-Fort Worth area on time for a riot or spitting at Stevenson's face a few weeks earlier, and then they got involved in the Kennedy assassination. Oswald's role of communist was a CIA cover played up by Army Intelligence Agent Ed Butler, who works for Schick Razor and ballpoint pens for Patrick Frawley. That was a cover. So through all of this, the communist, the Jew, there was an effort to discredit and lump these people together as the reason for the assassination of John Kennedy, that the communist conspiracy was behind it. At that time, as I say, I was raising my family, and it flashed to me the diary of Anne Frank. And I remembered the diary that Anne left when her father was out of the concentration camp. If you remember, it was a family that was taken off in Holland, and all of the members of the family died except the father in concentration camp. He was freed when the American Army came. And Anne wrote in a diary that the father found the people are really good, something to the effect, I forget the exact wording, but to the effect that people are really good. And I realized that it was people like Mr. Frank, not Adolf Hitler, who was responsible for Anne Frank's death. because his kind voted in Hitler, and the people that were murdered in Germany, where hundreds of public officials were taken away long before Mr. Frank's time came, and he did nothing. He looked the other way. And I felt that if my children fall into a Nazism in America, it's not going to be because I sat by and Ireland did nothing. I had a large house at the time, a tennis court. I had a lot of help. But these children and I had everything a person would want. I had no financial worries. I was very comfortable. And I realized that if I sat back, like the garden, Fizzi Contini that was made recently about Italian family, that sat back and played tennis, enjoyed their good life until the day they were taken to the concentration camp. I felt that either this was a conspiracy and fascism would come into this country, or it wasn't. And as long as I had these five children, I was going to find out just what happened in Dallas, so I'd know which way to educate them or to educate myself. And that's how I came to work on the John Kennedy assassination. My contention, like Anne Frank or Mr. Frank, is that all people are born good. But I'm realistic enough to know that through circumstances of poverty or prejudice or teachers or religious training or prison guards or police academies or military establishments, you teach to kill and hate. We live out in California near Fort Ord, a few miles from here, where they pick up these young American boys who really have no deep prejudice and no reason to have prejudice, and they show them movies and they give them bayonets and they yell, kill, kill, until they're bloody ready to kill, and then they ship them around the world to do their killing. So while people are born good, there comes a time where they're no longer good, and you have to be truthful to your children. I didn't want to be like Mr. Frank. I didn't want to lie to my children. And then the altruism came in when the selfishness began to end, and the altruism came in with sharing my work with other people, sticking my neck out. People say, well, there couldn't be a conspiracy because how come you're still alive if it's true? I don't have to be dead for what I'm saying to be true in terms of my research. I'm telling you that the facts I've uncovered for 10 years are accurate. And the reason I'm alive, I'm sure, is that the assassins are so much in power and the people are so lethargic that they can count on you out there to do very little. So as I worked in 10 years, I uncovered a web of conspiracies and murders and government crimes, and they branched out. It went beyond John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or Medgar Evers or Malcolm X, and it went into a systematic killing of blacks and a killing of Chicanos and American Indian leaders and musicians and lawyers and writers, U.S. attorneys, hippies, hitchhikers, and prisoners, political prisoners gunned down in the yards out here at Soledad for their beliefs. They get tired of being slaves, and when they speak up, they get killed. And I realized they were all part and parcel of this planet of conspiratorial men that come down on those who really see the light about how evil forces work against them and want to speak up. So my work enlarged, and I began to do my radio shows and share my research. And now I'm writing articles, and I'm working on a book called Murderville USA, which covers 200 to 300 murders. Oh, many, many more than that, but it's an outline of many of these more prominent people I'm talking about, or less prominent, but that have been in the news, how you trap these innocent people and slaughter them, and that's what I'm writing about now. The anniversary of Kennedy's death, I greet with a combination of emotions, which I thought I would share with you, because I feel that what goes through my head is a little bit different than most peoples in this country. There were about 10 of us in the United States who, the week of November the 22nd, became what you would call serious researchers. It started that week and stayed with it ever since. There's been hundreds of new ones that have picked up since that time. But the 10 of us have worked very, very hard on trying to find out who was doing all these murders and how they got out of town, what places they stayed at, how the news media covered up, how many bullets there really were, who picked up the bullets. And we've cross-filed endless hours and years of work. There was Maggie Fields in Los Angeles. None of us knew each other. Originally, we were each in our own separate little homes, but eventually we got to all connect and meet, at least by telephone and correspondence. Mark Lane in New York, Shirley Martin in Oklahoma, Sylvia Mayer in New York, Joe Justine in Germany, Patrick Buchanan from France, Penn Jones Jr. in Texas, David Lift in Los Angeles, Leo Savage in New York, Vincent Salandri in Pennsylvania, Harold Weisberg in Maryland. Those were the basic researchers that have really done a lot of extensive work. I find myself with three kinds of emotions 10 years later. One is anger, which I try to control. The other is disgust. And the other is satisfaction. If you can reconcile those three and wake up in the morning and do your work like 12 or 13 or 14 hours a day and accommodate three emotions. My anger, if I let it get at me, is directed at all those stupid fools who learn nothing from the lessons of history. The college professors, the lawyers, the educated elite who have the opportunity to undo the war since the Cold War, since World War II, and fell back into the same traps in this country. My anger is directed at people who see the crimes, who know they exist, but desire their job security more or the money that they're making from a job. The various professional people or otherwise that don't speak up. They send me letters, you know, they're afraid to call on the phone, the line is tapped. They send letters without return addresses, just inside the letter. People come visit your house and put a towel over their license plate so somebody outside can't see who they are. Very much the coward, because if we all spoke up, we'd find what was really on our minds. And then the public officials, the congressmen, the Justice Department, the people who are in a position, legally, that's their position to represent the interests of the people in the United States, who take no interest. If you write about conspiracies, they take that letter and put it in a file, and thank you very much, and what else do you have to show me, and that's it. So my anger goes to this type of person that brought in Hitler or brought in Gerald Ford right now and Mr. Jaworski, the whole Justice Department that we're seeing, and the Congress sits by, and the people who know better sit by, and these things shouldn't be allowed to get out of hand like they've gotten. My disgust is at a different level of the educational system, the schools, the social science teachers, the political science teachers, and the parents and families who lie to their children. They lie about the conspiracies, the evidence. They don't discuss or have conversations. They prefer to put the kids in front of the tube instead of sharing what's happening. I know in the course of raising my five children, their friends come over, they sit around, they ask questions, they're curious, they're like sponges. They want to know things. Most of them, almost every child or young person that comes through, they don't hear that kind of conversation in their homes. They don't know what's going on. They can't believe there's that much evidence. They can't believe people sit and read newspapers and, I suppose, or turn on a tube, and they sit around, and I know they're starving for information, but there's nowhere for them to get it. And then I have satisfaction in my own life, or otherwise I couldn't stand the bad news that's coming down. I find these facts. I'm willing to share them as the news breaks. We warn about coming events. I've made marvelous friends among various researchers and writers in the work that I'm dedicated to. I'm in touch with them all the time on the phone, meet them. Some of them are far away. We only meet occasionally, but we're very, very close. Some of them, we're doing talk shows across the country together on three-way things, like Sherman Skolnick and myself last week on, 2 weeks ago, at WFAA in Dallas, Texas. We did a show in Ohio, another one in Salt Lake City. And then I'm satisfied with my own self-respect. I started about a year and a half after Kennedy was assassinated. I was with Henry Miller, whom I liked very, very much, and I read all of his books, and he was one of my heroes. I'm fond of Henry. And I asked him what I should do. I'd done a year and a half's work on the Kennedy assassination, getting the original hearings of the commission, just getting started in them. Henry left Europe after World War II and came to the United States and later settled at Big Sur and then moved to L.A. And I asked him, is there any point in bucking this political system and fighting it head on? What do you do about it? Because Henry left Europe when Hitler, just before he came into France, and he never took a position. His feeling was that there's a curse on both political major parties or politics in general. You stay as far away from as you can. So Henry gave me advice, and he said, the politicians are corrupt and evil. You can't change them. It's a way of life of all of its own. And so no use fighting them. Just stay away from them. They're kind of a curse or a plague. But, he said, if, on the other hand, you have in your mind the project that you want to do and you think it's important to you, for your family, your children, or you, go ahead and do it full speed. If you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror, and you know you should be doing something, and you're putting it off and taking the easy way out, go full speed ahead and do what you have to do. And with that advice, I moved up to Carmel just right after that, unpacked the boxes and got the kids settled in new schools. And then I proceeded full speed with the research, and I've never regretted it. And I do it every day of my life, just about. I've been so close to the work and the facts of the assassination that I today, instead of going over them, I thought I would do something different. Anniversary of Kennedy's death, and because of the political era that we're going through and the turmoil in Washington now, we instead of talking about the errors of the Warren Commission, and I thought about talking on all the evidence that Lee Oswald never owned a weapon, or the fact that Oswald never fired a weapon, or Sirhan didn't kill Robert Kennedy. I have a range of things. I was going to play some records of Kennedy's speeches today, and then I thought this isn't the moment. And I decided to turn to something a little more philosophical that maybe would set the pace for the next year that comes ahead, where we'll continue the researchers to eke out the facts as long as we can. I think of the whole total era, politically, philosophically, and the changes we went through, and the amount of evidence that was destroyed, and the foul lies of public officials. And I think of Dallas 10 years ago, and all the way up to the Watergate Hotel. There's an article this month in Ramparts on Dallas to Watergate. My article in The Realist in June was the first one in the country to make the connections of Dallas to Watergate. And I think of Richard Nixon, who was in Dallas at the time of the Kennedy assassination, at the home of Murchison's home with J. Edgar Hoover, the evening of the 21st, where the final orders had to be given that JFK would be killed the next day. And I think of Lyndon Johnson working with the space agencies and organized crime, and Bobby Baker and the intelligence agencies, and all of them that were involved in the assassination. And I think of the tragedy of Lyndon Johnson. He died his lonely death away at his ranch, cut off from his political party. And the main operatives, Marina Oswald and Michael and Ruth Payne and George de Morenschild, who for 10 years have lived so quietly you don't even know their names or where they're living, and they're in hiding away from the rest of the world. And I think of Richard Nixon 10 years later, falling the hardest of all, so high up, he wanted the presidency, wanted the mandate, achieved on a succession of murders and manipulations and enemy lists and military squad inside of the White House. And the one thing that comes to my mind at this time appropriate to the Kennedy assassination is the essay of Emerson's on compensation. I think today, with our fast life and the way we live, we sometimes don't tend to pick up these books that give us a perspective of what's happening all around us. And I often read the essays of Emerson on self-reliance and on compensation, and they're very much a part of my life. Emerson's a Gemini, too. Maybe that's another one that I like. But Emerson did an essay on compensation, and it was written between 1836 and 1860. And I'm going to read it to you. I've only added three words. I haven't changed his essay. When he speaks of calamities, I added, along with calamities, the word assassinations. And when he lists the loss of loved ones through death, like a husband or wife, I've inserted also the president. And I think this essay, you will hear in it, as I read it to you, certain references that might refer to the expensive ranches that Lyndon Johnson had, or Nixon's expensive homes, or the people that stand over Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson, like ITT and Howard Hughes, and the White House aides that Richard Nixon had, or the wasted war in Southeast Asia, or lies to the people and promises never kept, like the special prosecutor we used to have, and the death of the electoral opponents. I think of all these things, and I'll read you Emerson's Law of Compensation, because what you're seeing in Washington now, with the decline of Richard Nixon and his reputation around the world, is exemplified. What happened to Nixon, what happened to Lyndon Johnson, and then his death at the ranch, is part of what Emerson refers to as the law of compensation. Now, this is what Emerson said. He believed there was a polarity, or an action and a reaction, in every part of nature, such as darkness and light, heat and cold, ebb and flow, inspirations and the expiration of life. You empty one place here and you condense there. There's inevitable dualism in every part of nature, in and out, up and under. And while the world is dual, so is every one of its parts in this nature. The entire system of things gets represented in every particle. No creatures are favorites, and a certain compensation balances every gift and every defect. The same dualism underlies the nature and the condition of man, as well as other parts of our society. For every excess, there is a defect, and every sweet has a sour. And every faculty, which is a receiver of pleasure, has an equal penalty put on its abuse. For everything you have missed, you have gained something else. And for everything you gain, you lose something. If riches increase, they are increased that use them. If the gatherer gathers too much, nature takes out of the man what she puts into his chest. If she swells the estate, it kills the owner. Nature hates monopolies and exceptions to her rule. And there is always some leveling circumstance that puts down the overbearing, the strong, the rich, the fortunate on the same ground with all the others. The farmer imagines power and place are fine things, but the president has paid dear for his White House. It has commonly cost him all his peace and the best of his manly attributes. To preserve for a short time so conspicuous an appearance before the world, he is content to eat dust before the real masters who stand erect behind the throne. He who by force of will or thought is great and overlooks the thousands has the responsibility of overlooking. Things refuse to be mismanaged long. Though no checks to a new evil appear, the checks exist and they will appear. If the government is cruel, the governor's life is not safe. If you tax too high, the revenue will yield nothing. Nothing arbitrary, nothing artificial can endure. Under all governments, the influence of character remains the same. The world itself is a crop of dew. The world's globe is a crop of dew, and we put our life into every act. If there is good, so there is evil, and all things are moral. The soul which within us is a sentiment. Outside of it is a law. You see, what we think is just a belief or a feeling in ourselves is a basic law. It exists outside. We feel its inspirations. Out there in history, we can see its fatal strength, what it does to us. Justice is not postponed. Justice is never postponed. A perfect equity adjusts its balance in all parts of life. The dice of God are always loaded. Take what figure you will, its exact value, no more, no less, it still returns to you. Every secret is told. Every crime is punished. Every virtue rewarded, every wrong redressed, in silence and in certainty. What we call retribution is the universal necessity by which the whole appears whenever a part appears. A man cannot speak but that he judges himself. With his will or against his will, he draws his portrait to the eye of his companions by every word. Persons and events may stand for a time between you and justice, but it is only a postponement. You must pay at last your own debt. The history of persecution is a history of endeavors to cheat nature, to make the water run uphill, to twist a rope of sand. An army, a military, a mob is a society of bodies voluntarily bereaving themselves of reason. Its actions are insane. It persecutes a principle. It would whip a right. It would tar and feather justice by inflicting fire and outrage upon the houses and persons of those who have these. We cannot part with our friends. We do not want to let them go. We sit and weep in vain. We cannot stay amid the ruins. Yet there are compensations in history, in calamity and in assassinations. A fever, a mutilation, a cruel disappointment, a loss of friends seems the most unpaid loss and unpayable. But yet there are years, 10 years, that reveal the deep remedial force that underlies all facts. The death of a friend, wife, brother, lover, child, president, which seemed nothing but privation, somewhat later assumes the aspect of a guide or genius. For it commonly operates revolutions in our own way of life. It terminates an epoch of infancy or of youth which was waiting to be closed. breaks up unwanted occupations or a household or a style of living, and allows the formation of new ones more friendly to the growth of character. I think that is the essay on compensation by Emerson, and it expresses the changes that I made in dedicating what was really a wasted life of pleasure-seeking to seeking out some of these truths. And I think when Richard Nixon speaks or Lyndon Johnson spoke, every word they say, they're judged. As Emerson said, they're judged by the words they say in front of the world. A man not can speak, but he judges himself. His words will come back and hit him. They're replaying the old speeches of Nixon and the old records, and some of these speeches sound silly. And I think it's important. The law of compensation is what is working now. No matter what appointments are made, how they cover up the crimes, how hard they work to conceal the conspiracies, the law of compensation is working, and the truth will come out for sure. To conclude this broadcast in memory of John Kennedy, I want to read just a little bit of the testimony of Jack Ruby before Earl Warren at the Warren Commission. Earl Warren and Gerald Ford went out to Texas to see Jack Ruby, and he begged them to take him to Washington, D.C., where he could explain how a conspiracy existed, and they wouldn't take him. They had taken Mr. Valachi from the mafia and underworld and given him a penthouse at Sing Sing, but they didn't want to know what Jack Ruby knew. Jack Ruby said to these men, it was June the 7th, 1964, Mr. Belli, that's his attorney, evidently didn't go into my case thoroughly or circumstantially. If he'd gone into it, he wouldn't have tried to vindicate me on an insanity plea to relieve me of all responsibility. Had Mr. Belli spent more time with me, he would have realized not to try and get me out completely free. I wanted to get on the stand and tell the truth what happened that morning, and he said, Jack, when they get you on the stand, you're speaking of a premeditated crime. And I said, I don't care. I want to tell the truth. He begged Earl Warren, get me to Washington. It's very important. I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of. This isn't the place to tell you, but I want to tell you, I'm not afraid. My life is in danger here, he said. Not the plea of execution, but I want to tell you what happened. The only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity, why my act was committed and why it can't be said here, why he shot Lee Harvey Oswald and why it couldn't be said in the Dallas jail. And Earl Warren said, well, if you think it's not safe to talk, if you're in danger of your life, feel free to say the interview is over. And Ruby said, well, what happens then? I didn't accomplish anything. And Earl Warren said, no, nothing was accomplished. And Ruby said, then you won't follow up with anything further? Earl Warren said, there wouldn't be anything to follow up. Ruby said, well, you have the power to do what you want to do without limitations. And Warren said, we have the right to take the testimony of anyone that we want. And I wouldn't have bothered to come to you, he said, if your sister hadn't told me. So you're free to refrain from testifying if you want. So Jack Ruby said, okay, if it takes my life to say this. This is volume 5 of the Warren Commission hearings. He said, if it takes my life to say it, Earl Warren, unfortunately for me, I'm giving the people the opportunity to get in power because of the act I committed. And it's put a lot of people in jeopardy for their lives. You can get more out of me, he said. Don't break up so soon. I'm in a tough spot, and I don't know what the solution can be. Through certain falsehoods that have been said about me to other people, the Birch Society, I'm as good as guilty as the accused assassin of President Kennedy. A certain organization wouldn't be so completely formed now, so powerfully to use me, because I'm of the Jewish extraction and Jewish faith, to commit the most dastardly crime that has been committed. I wish our beloved president, Lyndon Johnson, see, he trusted him in those days, would have delved deeper into the situation. Hear me, not to accept the circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. A whole new form of government is going to take over the country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. This is Jack Ruby, and Gerald Ford was in the room when he said that. If you don't give me a chance and take me back to Washington tonight and give me a chance to prove to the president that I'm not guilty, you'll see the most tragic thing that will ever happen. Maybe something can be saved. Something can be done. Right now, I want to tell you this. I'm being used as a scapegoat, and there's no greater weapon than you can use to create falsehoods about some of the Jewish faith, especially the terrible, heinous crime and the killing of President Kennedy. Now, he said, maybe something can be saved. This is in June 64. If I'm eliminated, there won't be any way of your knowing. You have lost me, though. You have lost me, Chief Justice Warren. I won't be around for you to come and question me again. You are the only one who can save me. I think you can't, but by delaying minutes, you lose your chance, and all I wanted to is tell the truth, and that is all. And Earl Warren left Jack Ruby, and Jack Ruby was murdered in the Dallas jail. He started to get injections, and his sister came and found him all bloated up and said, I've got to get my brother to a hospital. And they said, well, she wanted her own private doctor. They said, no, if you're going to call your doctor, we'll use the doctor at Parkland Hospital. They sent Jack Ruby to Parkland Hospital, and 3 weeks later, he died of a massive cancer. The coffin was sent to Chicago, where he was buried with orders that if the undertaker opened it, he'd be murdered. A three-week massive cancer they never had before in his life, and no indication or growth. Medication, x-ray, Jack Ruby begged Earl Warren. He said a whole new form of government would come in, that I was used by these people, and lives would be lost. So now it is the end of Camelot. It's 10 years later. The government did take over. Ruby was talking to the government. Earl Warren is part of that secret team that keeps the people from knowing the truth, and so was Lyndon Johnson, but Ruby didn't know it. He worked on a need-to-know basis, like the Cubans at the Watergate Committee, Mr. Sturgis or Gonzalez or Martinez, who thought that they knew who they were working high up, but they didn't know how high up they went into the Ellsberg doctor's files and robbed there. Jack Ruby was pleading with Earl Warren because he thought he wanted to know the truth. Earl Warren said, I could leave. I don't even have to speak to you. I wasn't even going to come out. And Ruby said, a whole new form of government will take over, and I want to tell you before that happens, because I won't be alive till tell you. And Earl Warren walked out, and Gerald Ford walked out, and they didn't want to know what Ruby knew, and Ruby was killed. And therefore, part of the plot involved not only the killing of John Kennedy and the killing of Officer Tippit in Dallas, Texas, and the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail by the Dallas police friend Jack Ruby, but then the subsequent murder of Jack Ruby. And the story of history, no matter how many people they kill, the story of the history isn't in the National Archives. The law of compensation, Emerson's law of compensation, will take care of those assassins, even if they're White House today and part of the espionage team. That was only 10 years. Richard Nixon has seen his decline. Lyndon Johnson saw his decline with his own party and people. So if there's no law to open up what's in the archives to get the facts, if all the evidence is destroyed outside of what we researchers have with our own papers, State Department papers and papers on Lee Harvey Oswald, the truth is that history has judged them, and the law of compensation is working. It'll work on them whether we get them to admit their deeds or not. Okay, our time is up, and I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.